This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The coronavirus pandemic has changed or slowed down almost every aspect of life in America in the past few months, except fatal police shootings. The Washington Post keeps a count of every lethal shooting by an on-duty police officer, and as of today, the count in 2020 is right on par with the average for recent years. George Floyd is the latest high-profile police killing, but communities are also mourning the murders of Tony McDade, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery, among others. Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown join me now for Back Channel, our series connecting culture and context. Mark Anthony Neal is James B. Duke Professor and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. Natalie Bullock Brown, a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at North Carolina State. Mark and Natalie, welcome back.
Hey, Frank. Good to be back.
Well, it's good to have you. As many years and months as we've been talking about these issues, we keep thinking that maybe this conversation changes things for the better. We may have to wait even longer. Natalie, what is your reaction and response to the protests over the last, and of course, the events over the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, well, I mean, I have to say I'm processing it all in real time. I think all of us are. I am, of course, heartbroken over the murders that have taken place over the past few weeks. George Floyd's murder was really a lot. It was almost too much to bear. I still have not seen the full video because I can't watch it. And the protests, you know, they both excite and hearten me, and you know, I'm at the same time very concerned about the lives of the Black folks in particular that are out in the streets. I think initially I sort of lost track because these deaths so overshadowed, in many ways, the pandemic. I lost track of the fact that protesters, you know, coming together in the hundreds is not a good idea in the midst of the pandemic. And yet, you know, it's a response. It is, and it's a legitimate response to real trauma that the Black community, and I'm talking about all of us, you don't have to be related to any of these young people and middle-aged people, for that matter, who have been killed at the hands of police and white vigilantes, to care and to feel it and to really be hurt, you know, by these shows of just clear lack of humanity or recognition of humanity. So I, you know, I'm really struggling. I'm torn by, you know, how I feel about what should be done and when it should be done. But I do know that what these protesters and what I've seen, from what I've seen, they are, a lot of them, most of them are young in Raleigh. A lot of them, I would say most of them, have been protecting themselves and wearing masks. I appreciate the fact that they're willing to put their bodies on the line, even as for this particular moment and in terms of these murders, but even in the midst of a pandemic, which, you know, doubles the risk.
Mark, how are you processing all of this? Yeah, you know, there's the events, there are the murders, then there's the response to the murders, there's police response using, you know, tear gas, rubber bullets, other less lethal measures. I mean, it's a lot to process. What's going on in your mind?
You know, George Floyd's murder feels like a culmination and of something, and the response, you know, feels like a breaking point. It's impossible to divorce this anti-Black violence that we're seeing in this particular moment from the kind of rhetoric and policy and actions that we've obviously seen since, you know, January 20th, 2017. It's also important not to divorce it from the raced realities of the COVID crisis in terms of the way that Black folks have been at risk and not taken seriously in Black communities, they're being over-policed around social distancing. At the same time, sometimes in the same cities, I'm thinking about New York in this context, you know, they're seeing white folks being handled with kid gloves around, you know, social distancing. And so you have all of this taking place, and then you have these examples of violence. And again, we talk about Ahmed, Aubrey, something that happened in February, but then comes into our consciousness, you know, in the middle of March, beginning of April, when this begins. We can't forget about the killing of Breonna Taylor, which, because we don't have videotape of it, never, you know, became the kind of national focus that George Floyd's murder became, but it's just as insidious. And we can't forget that just a few days before George Floyd's murder, we were all caught up in the conversation around Kristen Cooper, the bird watcher, the black bird watcher in Central Park, and a white woman who attempted to bring the police to bear in ways that we knew could have ended up in a lethal situation. And so when you see the young folks now respond to this, you know, it's a breaking point for them. I've been struck by the fact of particularly the national corporate media, you know, we're seeing some of the same questions, the same people in some cases. And it's as if, you know, Baltimore didn't explode in 2015. It's as if Ferguson didn't explode in 2014. If we want to look at a longer history that's not recent history, but, you know, something that occurred in our lifetimes, you know, we could think about L.A. in 1992 and Watts in 1965. We have these historical moments where young folks feel that there's a breaking point and they need to respond to it. And I think one of the things that's really interesting about this moment, and I think about Minnesota in this context, which of course has this large Minneapolis, which has this large Somali population, we're now seeing a different kind of demographic, if you will, of protesters, right? You're talking about second generation folks who immigrated here, sometimes from places like Somalia and Nigeria and Ghana and other places, who came to the United States expecting not to have to deal with this kind of violence. And for some of them, this is the first time that they have to come face to face with this violence, as we have, you know, African American folks who've been here for centuries also dealing historically with this reality.
But let's talk about that, this business of this being cyclical in a way. And that it goes way back, and you can remember 65 and 67, and then in the 90s, and then again in more recent, the more recent past. Natalie, I mean, you know, part of the question is, what good does it do? I mean, because in between those outbursts of violence, there is the peaceful effort at collaboration, at using the system in order to transform the system, and doing it. And so, and far more time has been spent doing that than in these momentary outbursts. None of it has resulted in the kind of change that we want to see. We're still doing this. We still have a legislature in North Carolina that has been caught in the 21st century repressing the black vote by the courts. Still.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that what is striking about this particular moment is the pandemic and the way that it has forced all of us, I mean, globally, to slow down. We are now all in many ways, we're a captive audience. And you can't really escape the images. There's a way that when, you know, life is, quote unquote, back to normal, right, that we can bury ourselves in work, we can ignore or avoid the television, we can busy ourselves with the things of our lives, and we don't have to focus on what is going on around us. The pandemic has put that to an end, and I think that that is a part of the really the perfect storm, if you will, that is happening right now. And it's why there is this response, because the pandemic has intensified what we see and our feelings, I believe, of just needing to do, say enough is enough. Like, enough is enough. It's not enough that the pandemic is killing African Americans in disproportionate numbers. During a pandemic, there can't even be a pause on police brutality against Black people. You know, it just underscores the fact that, as you said, this continues regardless of what has been happening. And I just want to, you know, add to that, that part of what I believe is responsible for or feeds into this continual conflict that doesn't seem to want to go away is the fact that embedded in our culture are insidious representations of African Americans and insidious ideas and myths about African Americans that have not been dealt with. We barely deal with slavery, right? People want us to forget about it, to act as though that maybe that it didn't happen, but that it was all so long ago. We're not dealing with any remnants of it in this moment. And the sad reality is that all of the constructions that came out of slavery, of race, of white supremacy, the stereotypes and the caricatures that criminalize and hypersexualize Black people, that say that we're lazy, that we're no good, all of these things, even though people may not say them out of their mouths, although certainly over the past 3 years, people are doing it more. But that stuff is in the American psyche. And until that is addressed, until we address the fact that this is what folk believe about Black people, then in a moment when Black death is all around us, and it's always been there, right? We just haven't always had cell phone footage to bear witness to it. But until we do the surgery necessary to get these images, these ideas about Black people out of our brains, it's going to continue. And the systems that reinforce this stuff, that feed law enforcement, that feed healthcare disparities, that feed all the ways that Black people continually are disenfranchised, we will continue to see this. And so I'm hoping that in this moment, in this way that the protests and the pandemic are asking us to pause and think and change, that we will do that work.
Well, Mark, what do you think? Is this the moment? Is there something different about this moment that could actually cause a lasting change?
I'm not sure. You know, we see the number of white folks who are on the front lines, you know, some of them out of the goodness of their heart and a real allyship, you know, some of them, you know, to cause trouble. I'm often struck in these moments, you know, there are many white Americans and many Americans of all races, even Black folks, for which the killings of the George Floyds and the Breonna Taylors of the world are simply collateral damage for the safety that they derive from white supremacy. And until they see white supremacy as something that's actually making their humanity something less, until they see white supremacy as something that poses a threat to who they are, they will not be really moved by the deaths of Black folks because, again, it's the trade-off, you know, for the idea of being safe and being protected by the idea of white supremacy. You know, to Natalie's point about these historical images and ideas about Black folks and to talk about the intersection of this at the COVID moment with police brutality, you know, this idea that, you know, that Black folks can withstand amazing amounts of pain, right? It's the same reason why Black folks get underdiagnosed in the healthcare system. And it's the same reason why folks think that a Black man who's already subdued and has handcuffs on needs 4 police officers, if not more, in order to continue to subdue him. These historical ideas about how Black folks have to be contained and curtailed and policed, controlled and incarcerated. And again, when you think about the interesting dichotomy of how folks are viewing these protests, right, which for the most part have been largely directed at, you know, peaceful protests, but when they've become violent, it's largely been directed at property and not necessarily people. The different kind of language that we use to describe white armed protesters going into state governments to protest the opening or the lack of opening of, you know, states around COVID, And the fact that we have a larger history of black folks who have also protested nonviolently with guns and arms, like the Black Panther Party, that necessitated, in the case of the state of California, for them to actually change the laws about carrying guns. So even when we do protest peacefully, there's this perception that violence, right, is the potential outcome of our involvement.
Well, talk more about that. I mean, the difference in the way the reopen protest, and as you said, many people were armed and in many cases were sort of flashing their weapons at these protests. Very different kind of policing than we saw for the protests, these anti-police brutality protests.
Oh, absolutely. If five black people are walking down the block armed, regardless of what they're doing, they will be arrested. They won't even get an opportunity to express the nonviolent aspect of their protest. So we see these dichotomies. And this is the thing, the young folks who are media savvy in the ways that previous generations of folks haven't been because we simply didn't have access, right? They also are witnessing this double standard around how they are treated and acting accordingly.
But this is, and Natalie, I want to get back to something you were suggesting earlier, and it gets to something that Ava DuVernay said, you know, when she was talking about the criminal justice system, saying it's not broken. It's doing exactly what it is designed to do. That's what we have right. to get through our heads. But the question right. is that these things do tend to polarize. Mark's point that when, you know, until, you know, sort of white working class folks start to understand that they are the victims of this very same process and that the trick of dividing black people from white people has been very successful at keeping them from looking at the real target. But it is a successful trick, is it not? And sort of how do you penetrate that? I mean, I'm not asking you to solve it, but as you meditate on this, because the protests seem to galvanize and sort of harden those folks who are already afraid of losing their supremacy right. into their position, which is not to say don't do it, but it's how do you fix right. this?
Yeah. I mean, of course, I only know what I know, right? So I do believe that there are a whole bunch of things taking place at once, and absolutely everything is working as it was designed to work. And so what has to happen with white working class people, I think, is different from what has to happen with white progressives. Because let's remember that the woman who, you know, called the police on Christian Cooper in Central Park worked on Obama's campaign. So there is a way that white progressives, you know, are complicit in one part of this, right? In a certain arena of this cauldron, and then working class whites, because of, you know, similar disenfranchisement, who want to attach to their whiteness and say, this is what's supposed to entitle me to the benefits and the freedoms and all the things that I see and see a lot of black people accessing, but that I hear the president of the United States identifying as mine, then, you know, there are a lot of different fronts on which we have to fight this fight. And honestly, you know, a lot of the fight is not a fight for black folks, because there's a way, I mean, clearly, that our voices do not cut through to working class white people. There is also a way that our voices don't cut through to progressive white people. And they listen. But I think that in this moment, what is penetrating the background noise that has kept white progressives from really paying attention to what goes on, what their black friends have been telling them about black life in this country for years, is that they have had to sit and watch and hear about and see posted about and commented about Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor and George Floyd and Sean Reed. The list goes on, and they cannot escape it. And so I think the pandemic, God bless it, for this pause, for this moment where we have to pay attention, where we can't go anywhere. But it's going to take, like, everything that Mark was talking about, it's going to take the uprooting of these ideas. It's going to take us addressing this double standard. And really, it's going to take the dismantling of these systems that have been designed.
Natalie Bullock Brown, Mark Anthony Neal, thank you both for being on this edition of Back Channel.
Thank you.